Welcome to the Doctor Who Review Show 2015.
Doctor Who, the witch is familiar. So what blew me away in this episode? The sonic sunglasses, hello! Those were amazing. Where can I get a pair?
Okay, what blew you away in the episode?
Didn't we just do this?
Yeah, we're doing it every week.
What blew those buildings away in that episode?
Okay.
What blew me away? I think Clara being back in the Dalek blew me away. Because I found that quite frightening that she was back where we first met her.
Okay, what blew you away in the episode? There are things you think you'll never see in Doctor Who, and the Doctor zooming around like a kid in Davros's chair, while Davros, well, half of him at least, lies writhing on the floor, is an image I couldn't believe I was seeing, even though I was seeing it.
Something that really blew me away in the episode, which carries on from the last episode, was Julian Bleach's performance. The pathos was incredible. It was just a beautiful portrayal of a weak, dying man that really got to me. And for the first time in the history of New Who, despite all the attempts at overblown sentimentality that's come before through Russell T Davies' tenure and Stephen Moffat's, I actually cried, which is quite a big deal for me, particularly when you see the first shot of Davros having been ripped from his chair by the Doctor, lying completely helpless on the ground. That really, really got me.
The bit where the Doctor presumably, you know, drags Davros out of his chair and dumps him on the floor, and you're just looking at him lying there writhing, and he's kind of gone from the waist down. There's a little bit of spine flapping about and some cables hanging out. Because we've always wondered what was going on in Davros's wheelchair.
I was blown away by that scene where the Doctor and Davros are, you know, sitting eye to eye, literally, and just talking, and the similarities in how, like, you know, Daleks were suddenly turning equal to Time Lords, and the similarities between the two and good and bad were just blurring altogether, and it was just so fascinating. It blew me away.
What didn't do it for you? What didn't work?
Wait, did you replace that with what did work?
These are new questions. We get new questions every week.
Oh, because that second one's way more fitting than whatever it was I got last week.
Yeah, okay. So what didn't do it for you?
The episode.
Oh, right. Mostly. Okay.
Something that really, really didn't do it for me in the episode was the contrast between the incredibly emotional interchange between the Doctor and Davros in the first two-thirds of the episode, which were remarkably affecting, and then cutting to the runaround with Clara and Missy, which didn't really feel that perilous to me and seemed like comic relief. It sort of felt like watching a really beautiful and moving film and someone cutting in Benny Hill clips.
What didn't do it for me? The sewer thing didn't do it for me. How Skaro just blew up because of their dead people, the way they treated their dead. I didn't really see the mechanical death part involved of how this mushy substance could climb into the holes of a Dalek and somehow kill it. I mean, it's juice. It's Dalek smoothie. How are they physically being harmed? I didn't get that.
What didn't do it for me was Davros with his advice and his human side and crying. I thought, what's going on here? I thought it was a bit rubbish, but then, oh, crikey. All changed, big twist, and it all came better again. But I was watching it thinking, I don't like this bit.
I never like things that are overly explained. I like an element of magic or, you know, short of that, just plain mystery in what I'm watching. And Missy explaining point after point about the Daleks to Clara, including stuff like they say exterminate to recharge themselves, kind of takes away rather than adds something.
What didn't do it for me in this episode? I forgot to mention last week, I hate snakes. Ugh, they're the worst. So, Colony Sarf? Nope. I will be okay if I never see him again in my life. Too many snakes. Get rid of the snakes.
What didn't do it for me? I've got very few complaints about that episode. After the, in The Magician's Apprentice, where you had the bit in Essex with the tank and the guitar, or Axe Gate, as I think we should start calling it.
What did we think of the resolve?
In terms of the resolution, it didn't quite do it for me, if I'm honest. I was a little underwhelmed, but I don't really see how else they could have done it. It wouldn't really be Doctor Who without a little bit of schmaltz and a bit of a reset button.
For me, the resolve hung together well enough that I could happily get through the episode, but the more you think about it, did that young boy really have no mercy at all until the Doctor went back and talked about it for 10 seconds? He seemed like such a nice kid.
The resolve was great. We loved a nice bit of tidy time travel towards the end.
So, on the subject of the resolution, my only question is, how does a sewer full of decaying Dalek matter, even when imbued with regenerative energy, how does that then rise up through the city, and why would it then start eating its way or burrowing its way into Daleks and killing them?
I loved the resolution of this episode. I was worried that it was going to turn into Kill the Moon, where a lot of the ethical questions involved were just going to dissipate into nothing of consequence. But this time, there was a strong message, and I am so proud to call myself a Doctor Who fan.
What did you think of the resolve? Well, it hasn't been resolved, really, has it?
No.
We're still in the middle of it. That's part two of a multi-part story. Right, okay.
Now the resolve. I liked it. I thought that was good. A good message about mercy and the whole thing about friends and enemies. And especially with wartime, it seems like those lines get blurred a lot of times. And it just depends on which part of the world or what part of the galaxy in this case that you're born in, which side is going to be your enemy. And so mercy, that's what it's all about. Just showing mercy. And it seems to go along with the theme of Doctor Who very nicely.
So after an episode like that, everyone will be talking about Davros and the Doctor and the Daleks and the Doctor and the relationship between Clara and the Doctor. And I thought what might get lost in the mix at this point is that special friendship between who Rassilon described as the Doctor and the Master. Two Time Lords, two rival Time Lords, best friends, sworn enemies, nemesis, chums. I think this two-parter really does kind of usher in a new era in their friendship, in their relationship rather, but it's not unprecedented. And I think if you go back to the very start of their televised adventures together, when it was the Delgado Master against Big Bird, John Pertwee, you had this sense of, you know, the Master will do all he can to get one over on the Doctor, but it's gentlemanly, it's sort of friendly, it's well-mannered, there's a lot of simpering, and there's visiting the Master in prison, and sword fighting, and it's all slightly camp, but slightly gentleman's club, and there's a lot of love in the room. And it's only really after Delgado that the Master becomes slightly more of a two-dimensional figure. If you look at the adventures of Tom Baker versus Skeletor in The Deadly Assassin, and just before Legopolis, Keeper of Trakan. In those two, then the Master is portrayed as a slightly desperate figure, clinging to life grimly by the rotting fingernails in his horrible talons. And it was all about kill the Doctor, take his lives, take his body, death, death, death. I must survive. At which point they've moved beyond the kind of pattern of two friends, one of whom has got a little bit jealous of the other's success and secretly wants to do them down. I'm sure it's happened to most of us in our lives where you feel overshadowed by a best friend. There's a very good novel by Martin Amis called The Information, which basically, in the characters of Richard Tull and Gwyn Barry, looks at the same relationship as the Doctor and the Master. The Master, I don't think, was born an evil lunatic. I think he's been driven to desperate acts to try and upstage the Doctor and to try and outsmart him and to try and prove to himself as much as the universe that he is in some way equal to the Doctor. He just wants attention. He just wants recognition. But it's turned him evil. And it was with the Anthony Ainley Master, my favourite Master. By the time he was locking horns with Davison, Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy, he was a different figure. He'd been on some sort of supervillains training course. They'd sat him down. They said, look, if you're going to be bad, wear black and you have to learn the evil chuckle. You have to go, ah, and that's basically what Anthony Ainley, or his Master, was famous for. His schemes were madder than Delgado's. A lot of people have commented that the Master stopped making sense really after the Delgado era, and the idea that him and the Doctor would keep bumping into each other became faintly ridiculous. The Master went down a gear in terms of being a sustained character and just became someone who would be resurrected from the dead, have an insane scheme that would ultimately lead to the death of his best friend, the Doctor. It would be an overly elaborate scheme, obviously. It would go wrong, the Master would fail, and end up looking really rather foolish while the Doctor sauntered away in quite a smug way. One thinks of Ainley's antics in Time Flight. One thinks of him pretending to be a scarecrow in Mark of the Rani. And, you know, it's a kind of devalued Master. But think of him in Survival. Think of him at the climax of Trial of a Time Lord. He's there, he's gloating, he's relishing, he's so close to seeing the Doctor's downfall, and that's all he wants. He just wants his moment in the sun where he can go, hey, you know what? Ha, he's not all that. I'm just as valid. I wonder if maybe they had maybe one particular teacher they both particularly respected, perhaps Barusa, and that teacher favourited the Doctor, and that's what put the Master on this sort of bitter course where he became more and more consumed by his own sense of inadequacy and jealousy. What happened next for the Master was terrible news. After he got off the planet of the Cheetah People, he was captured by some sort of Smurf Daleks, put on trial and blown up. Fortunately, he'd swallowed this sort of snaky thing, which was able to turn him into Eric Roberts, who, through no fault of his own, but purely because of the demands of the story, was playing a sort of all-purpose villain. It was a bit Terminator. He was sort of relentlessly going about his business, trying to get his hands on the Doctor's clock. I said clock! And there were some good lines in there. There was some indications of the length and closeness of their friendship. But again, the Master was there basically to kill the Doctor and steal all his lives and dreads fantastically for the occasion. That was fine. It was good. It would have been interesting to see how that friendship would have gone. I think they were kind of good, a good match physically and sort of age-wise. The two actors, you know, to go up against the golden voice of Paul McGann, you need to be able to hold your own. And Eric Roberts, for all the stick he gets in fandom, I thought he was quite good, and I think it would have been very interesting to see him and Paul McGann locking horns over a period of several years on a major American TV production. That didn't happen, so we then came back to the Master as resurrected after his years hiding at the Silver Devastation, when he turned into John Sim quite unexpectedly and quite brilliantly. And Sim's Master is a polarizing figure with a lot of good and a lot of bad points, but you can't deny he was a great match with Tennant. They were both on the same page. They had the same energy. There was a yin and yang thing again. You got the feeling that they were kind of choosing their bodies specifically to kind of chime with each other, which is a sort of homoerotic subtext, which perhaps we shouldn't go into. And at the end of the Last of the Time Lords, where the Master has been shot, spoilers, but this was years ago, and he's dying, and the Doctor is cradling him, and he's begging him to regenerate because he doesn't want to be alone, because the Master is his best friend. There was genuine affection there, which was kind of undone by the nonsense of the end of time, which we will not talk about. Safe to say that the Master once again demonstrated his love and affection for the Doctor by saving his life and stranding himself back on Gallifrey with his enemies, the Time Lords. And that was pretty much the Master's story done, or so we thought. And then Missy comes back and everyone's saying there are elements of Delgado to her portrayal, to the lighter approach she's bringing. She's not just here to kill the Doctor. She's here to mess with him. She's here to confound him. She's here to wrong foot him. Also, I think there were hints of Ainley in her, certainly in part two. There was some wonderful stuff in there. And I think Missy is bringing a much more nuanced performance. It's not that she's a feminized Master, therefore suddenly because she's a girl, she's trying different things. She has gone back to the playful friendship aspect of the relationship between those two figures, and she's thought about this, and she's saying, right, well, what, you know, I'm not just going to turn up and kill him, because if I can do that, I would. If I can't do it, I'd give up. And the Master would have given up by now if there wasn't something beyond mere petty hatred keeping his vendetta against the Doctor going. It must be a jealous friendship, and that will endure, and I can't wait to see how it unfolds, hopefully again in this series, because I think Missy will be back. He generally is.
The last episode, The Magician's Apprentice, threw up some interesting questions. Beth, Ian and Rob let you know what they think.
So, who was the magician and who was the apprentice? For mine, I think the magician has to be the Doctor. He wears the magician type jacket. He's been referred to as a magician before, and Clara is clearly his apprentice. And in fact, this episode, she was getting around being so incredibly doctorish. A lot of the reviews I've heard, particularly outside this review show podcast, have had people complaining a little to some degree that Clara is a bit too doctorish. So she's certainly walking in the Doctor's footsteps, being called into unit, doing things with Kate Stewart and so on. So I think the Doctor is the magician, Clara is the apprentice. Who is the witch and who is the familiar?
Based on the first episode, I think it's fair to say that the magician and apprentice would be Davros and the Doctor, although who takes on which role I think is quite likely to be flipped on its head in The Witch's Familiar. Right now, it seems that the Doctor as the magician has a massively influential impact on young Davros's life. So the assumption is that Davros is the apprentice. But I'm prepared to be proved wrong with whatever happens in The Witch's Familiar.
There is that old saying that advanced science is indistinguishable from magic to a more primitive audience. I think it was from the demons, in fact, but I could be completely wrong. And by that rationale, if you imagine you're an ordinary Khalid infantryman or soldier, and you see this guy working in the laboratory who takes your colleagues and accelerates them and force evolves them into some ultimate proto form and then seals it in a hostile tank and does that to your whole species, and you win the war and you conquer half the universe, that might be seen as magic, and you might therefore regard Davros as a magician, a wizard. But then again, who would Davros's apprentice have been? There isn't an apprentice figure, so logically the title of the episode probably implies that Davros sees the Doctor as a magician for the way he comes and goes, rescues him presumably from the handy creatures, and therefore Davros becomes the Doctor's apprentice. And whether there's a scene in episode two where the Doctor spends a year hanging out with young Davros, training him and trying to make him a good scientist, which may or may not happen, who knows. But I can't get away from it's the relationship between those two that's being explored in that title.
Well, I may sound like a bit of a broken record here, but I think the witch is Missy and the familiar is Clara. So Clara is both the witch's familiar and the magician's apprentice. And the reason I think this is, I think this next episode, the Doctor might be off doing his own thing with Davros, either the old one, like we've seen in a little bit of footage recently, or he's off with the younger one, either saving him or not saving him or whatever. Meanwhile, I think Clara and Missy will be together. So while earlier, while Clara was acting like the magician's apprentice, in the second episode, she'll be acting more like the witch's familiar.
I reckon Missy's the witch. She has power and technology and experience on her side. And because she's almost certainly not dead, and nor is Clara, and they're very likely to be teamed up in this week's episode, having not seen it yet, I can imagine Missy treating Clara like a pet and some kind of witch is familiar, like a cat to be kind of looked down upon and patronised.
The kind of question that arises from that then is, let's look at the witch's familiar. Who's the witch? Who's the familiar? It's very tempting to say that Missy would be the witch because we live in a sexist universe and she's a woman and she seems to be able to do magic, in that she's shot pretty much every episode now. She gets blown to smithereens and yet won't die. There's a number of reasons for that. Either she's perfected some system in her biological makeup to overcome death, or it's that vortex manipulator she's wearing and Clara is wearing and is slaved to Missy's. Who knows what's going to happen there? But her familiar, it would be the Doctor, surely. Or would it be... I don't know, it's a puzzler, isn't it?
As for Colony Sarf, I don't know what his real origin story is and what the details are, but knowing that Davros is the foremost geneticist on Skaro, I can imagine that a gestalt, snaky entity could easily have been created by the man behind Daleks. So all I think you really need to know is he's some kind of genetic monstrosity created by Davros.
I think it's a far easier question to analyse where this Colony Sarf character came from, this sort of human snaky fella. I mean, it's quite simple to me. Davros is sitting there thinking, I need an avatar to go amongst the stars. And he's bored, it's raining, he puts the telly on, they're showing one of the Harry Potter films. He's looking at this giant talking snake and thinking, I would be a Slytherin. And being a geneticist, he's able to force evolve someone into a giant folding up-y snaky monster that refers to him. He can train it to refer to him as the Dark Lord so he can get his Voldemort yayas out, and is able to send this snaky fella among the stars. I don't know, maybe there's a planet of snaky people that Davros has at some point enslaved. I don't imagine we're actually going to get any sort of answer about that. I think it's the sort of thing Moffat throws at the screen just to add kind of texture and depth and background, but just doesn't realise how much it annoys people who want to be told absolutely everything.
Who is and what is the background of Colony Sarf? You know, there are so many characters in Doctor Who these days who are just throwaway. I mean, Tasha Lem, there's one that comes instantly to mind. Who is Tasha Lem? She was in an episode, she's gone now. She was apparently very important and meaningful to the Doctor, but we've never seen her before or since. And I think Colony Sarf could be in that category. But if I was to just throw some imagination at who he might be, I think Davros has genetically created him. I think, obviously, Davros has these skills. He's mutated the Khaleds down to little green blobs. I'm sure he can do all sorts of things with genetics. And I think he's created Colony Sarf somewhere along the line. We'll be right back.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you, little bear?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm sensational.
Good.
Because I watched Doctor Who.
I watched Doctor Who as well. Well, number one is top Christmas toy is going to obviously be Dalek body that you can sit in and ride around.
I had a problem with the Davros chair.
Didn't you like it?
He pulled, ripped Davros from his chair.
Like
right, it was obviously got plugs and wires in it,
yes,
and sockets. Yeah. And how did he get his gangly legs in it? Because then half an hour later, Davros is back in it.
I think it would be a good toy, though.
It would be a good toy, yes.
Did you also notice, I think it was the Panton chair that Doctor was sat in at some point. The only chair on Scarrow was a Panton.
Where, I wonder where Davros bought that.
Probably a Chinese copy.
A Scarrow copy?
Yes. What do we think of the wearable technology?
It was a bit of a con, really, wasn't it? It's just a pair of sunglasses. You know, yeah. It's like when you're a little kid and you just get... Like, I used to get my dad's tape measure from when he was building stuff in the garage. You know, the tape measures that extend out. I used to get them and extend it out a bit and pretend it was a walkie-talkie.
Oh, yes. Yes, I used to do
breaker, that. Breaker, breaker, 10-4 for a copy. And then he used to say, you'll bend that, give it back. So I don't know, but I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? It's a cheap bit of merchandise. Any kid could go to the pound shop and buy a pair of sunglasses and put them on and stand there going, beep, 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 beep. Sonic sunglasses.
It's a sonic screwdriver for poor families that can't afford to shop at Toys R Us. What's on your notes?
Right, I've got some rude words.
Oh.
Right, first of all, right at the end of the episode, I only noticed this because when Mrs. At the end of the episode, and Mrs. says, I've got a great idea of how to get out of here or whatever, and all the Daleks are coming, there's a shot and you see the Dalek with its balls on its skirt, and then it cuts to a scene of the Doctor and Clara staring at the city being blown up, and Clara's skirt has got little balls on it.
Really?
What a nice little change. Did you notice the balls on Clara's skirt?
Ah, that's quite nice, that. When we first met Clara, she was in a Dalek, so...
She was, wasn't she? And she did that again. And that was a bit like Davros's chair. She managed to sit in a Dalek that had been designed for a blob.
Yes.
Yet she's a person.
Mm.
When the Doctor and Davros were having a chat, and Davros was playing the, you know, the sadness card, saying, but I can't open my eyes. And the Doctor said, don't tell anybody. Before he used the regeneration energy, they were sat quite close together at eye level, and when he said, don't tell anybody, I thought he was going to lean in for a snog.
Oh, that would be magical, wouldn't it? Don't tell anyone, but I've always had feelings for you.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. That could be an alternative ending.
So at the end of the day, the Daleks were defeated by talking Dalek poo.
The sewers were revolting.
And it was in their eyes and everything. If it had been a Russell T. Davies episode from back in the day, they'd probably put farty sound effects on it as it infiltrated the Daleks and made it a bit more comical. What else have you got?
When Davros was saying, poor me, and have I done right, I thought that was a bit crap. So I was quite pleased when it spun round.
I didn't like his eyes open.
I didn't. He looked too human.
I liked his joke where he told the Doctor that he wasn't a very good doctor.
Yes.
How did Davros develop a sense of humour? This always gets me about bad guys like Darth Vader and Davros. They're always busy being baddies. When do they have time to sit down and read a Beano or, you know, watch a Tim Vine DVD and have a good old giggle with a cup of tea? When do they do that? I don't think they do. They're always being well domineering, aren't they?
Maybe they've got a cheesy little northern Dalek type pub where they have stand-up comedy nights.
They're not going to sit down, are they? What do you think about the look of next week's, because it's got ghosts in it?
I've got a thing that is in the dark anyway, but this is the only appear at night or in the dark, wasn't it? I've only seen it once. And I'm 33 now, and I still run and jump into bed for reasons like that. I like being home alone, but my imagination's too vivid, and then I start to get frightened.
But it's nice that we're finishing on a retro film reference again with Home Alone, so shall we?
Oh, yeah.
Let's say goodbye to everyone by doing a Kevin scream. 1, 2, 3.
G'day everyone, Dr. Robert here with the test results for The Witch's Familiar. Take a seat, this won't take long. First up, wow, a two-parter with a second part better than the first. While it's not the first time this has happened in New Who, a second episode always leaves the door open to being not as good or allowing the story to slump in the middle because there's just not enough to stretch across the full 90 minutes, to the point where I approach two-parters with caution. And with this series featuring so many two-parters, I think fandom is going to be on real tenterhooks every other week as we wait to see what the outcome's going to be. But this was one of the good ones. One of the first things I said after the episode ending was that I'd figured out aspects of it. I think my prediction that the Doctor would come back and shoot the hand mines, for example, ended up on the cutting room floor last episode, but I did call it. But there were other elements of the episode that I couldn't have imagined in a million years before the episode aired, which delighted me. For example, the concept of the Dalek sewer slash graveyard, that was spot on, it was spooky, and the image of all these bits of Dalek, like excrement just bubbling up and attacking everyone, was foul, amazing, gut-churning, and brilliant. You can't guess that sort of thing's going to happen until it's actually there on the screen happening. Then there was the concept of the Daleks not knowing the word mercy.
I'm River Song. Check your records again.
Mercy!
Say it again.
Mercy!
Let's move quickly along from that, shall we? Missy continued to be a great character in this episode. She had even less moments of dark water slash death in heaven style madness than in the last episode, albeit with the odd moment of dropping into a southern US drawl for some reason. Here, she was very much the Time Lady, as she reminded us, taking great delight in being as much a foil to the Daleks as the Doctor usually is. Of course, she had her moment of great betrayal in trying to get the Doctor to kill Clara, but that was a moment of pure, non-crazy master. That's something I could see my ideal Delgado-style master trying to pull on Pertwee and Joe Grant. Like I said last time, if Missy had been a bit more like this in the final episodes of Series 8... it would have been great. It would have cemented her character from the very start. Instead, while many of us chuckled at lines like Dr. Chang, in the long run, this is a master who can return and isn't a one-trick pony with the crazy routine. I spoke last time about the concept of doing the right thing by people and whether the message would be that it doesn't get you anywhere. And you know, for a fleeting moment when Davros had turned the tide on the Doctor with this scene...
Look. Help me take this mask off.
But you'll die.
Nothing can stop that now. Just for once, let me look on you with my own eyes.
Sorry, that was the wrong IP. With his weepy opened eyes, I thought, oh boy... that's going to be the message. The Doctor's trying to be nice and ending up getting all his regeneration energy drained. Of course, it turned out to be all right in the end. And just as an aside, I thought Davros lost his eyes in a lab accident years ago, or is that just my mind making stuff up? And also, just on regeneration energy, River Song had to give up almost a whole regeneration cycle. I think she was only one or two into hers to bring the Doctor back to life once. How much regeneration energy did Capaldi lose, juicing up Davros and a whole Dalek city for that period of time he was hooked up to the machinery? You'd have to assume, based on the rules that were set a few years back, that he's lost at least some regenerations in the process. I wonder if a future showrunner in 20 years' time might play with that idea, or whether it'll be quietly tossed to one side and never mentioned again. Ultimately, I really liked this episode and the one before it. They weren't perfect in every way, but what is? As good, fun episodes with some great scenes and some killer lines, also some gorgeous bits of music in places. I think I might even have to seek out some of these recordings on CD. These two episodes delivered. As I said earlier in the show, if producer Andy uses the clip, that is, even if some aspects don't quite hang together or make full sense if you think about them too much, the story overall and the enjoyment it brings kind of buys it a leave pass. Now, compare and contrast that with something like Kill the Moon from last series, where the concept seemed a bit ropey from the start and Clara acted quite stupidly on multiple levels, and by the time the magical space dragon had hatched and the moon disappeared, and then the magical space dragon dropped out a new moon that was actually bigger than itself, There was just no goodwill to go around. This was quite different. Not only was the resolution not as crazy to begin with, but the episode had far too much going for it to be unlikable overall, in my book. My wife, who I mentioned in my last review as liking but being unsure of what to think of the previous episode, gave this a big thumbs up in the end. She loved Missy in particular. Now, I didn't give a score last time as we're only halfway through the story. We're only halfway through the movie. Together now as one story, I can confidently give The Magician's Apprentice and The Witch's Familiar a solid 8 out of 10, or 16 out of 20, or 80 out of 100. Take your pick, they're all the same thing. With the way I mark pretty hard, I mean, something has to be drop-dead pee-your-pants amazing to be getting 9s or 10s from me. That's a really, really good result for this story. I really liked it, and I'll see you next episode. Ring my friend, I said you called back a robber.
This is Al, and with me is Beth.
Hi.
Hello. And with us to discuss The Witch's Familiar, we have a very, very, very special guest. In that is someone who did music for 5 episodes of Doctor Who and redid the season 23 theme tune, amongst various other things, including work on Eerie Indiana, The Simpsons episodes, Red Dwarf, the Blake 7 radio series, and his own career as an electronic musician. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Dominic Glynn.
Hi there, thank you very much.
Hello. So, a little bit of a strange one, because rather than interviewing you for this one, we're going to be just sort of talking around the episode The Witch's Familiar itself and seeing what sort of thoughts and ideas come from that. But I've got a question that I was going to sort of pose to the two of you just to get us started. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, right. Okay, so, Mr. Glynn and Beth, is there likely to ever come a day when the Crumhorn will make a reappearance in Doctor Who?
God, I hope so.
Well, just weirdly, I've actually just done a track with the Crumhorn in it, so, yeah, really? Maybe it will one day.
Wow. I think I know why Al asked that question. I declared my love of Crumhorns in the Silurians.
Oh, right, okay.
On a different podcast when around Christmas last year, on the Blue Box podcast, and I declared that the Silurians was one of my favourite soundtracks because of its use of interesting
instrumentation. Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting question, because for now, for the last 10 years, it's been orchestras all the way down, as it were. Do you think
Yeah.
Do you think there's scope for a different approach?
Yeah, musically. Yeah, very differently. Yeah, I mean, I like a lot of what Murray does, but it's a bit generic for me, and it's a bit could almost belong in any adventure film. Whereas I kind of like the fact that Doctor Who traditionally had a very distinctive and unusual soundtrack, you know, which everybody would listen to and go, "Oh God, that's Doctor Who." And I think there's room for that now in the scores for the current series. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think a combination of the kind of orchestral power that you get from, you know, using a full orchestra would blend well with kind of some of the maybe slightly freakier electronics that we've all come to know and love from Doctor Who gone by.
It'd be quite nice, wouldn't it, to have more of an electronic theme to the music? I would have said, because it was cutting edge when it back in.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone's a bit scared of tampering with a formula that they've created, right. You know, and understandably, because everybody's watching the ratings and it's all sort of, you know, cutthroat business TV these days. So nobody really wants to sort of change anything too drastically in case it all falls apart in their hands. But I do think there's room for a bit of tinkering with the music, I think, put it that way. Mm-hmm. And yes, Doctor Who music used to be very innovative at times, you know, it's stuff that you wouldn't really hear anywhere else at all.
But do you think that in some senses it's possibly brought sci-fi into the mainstream in a way that, it, like you said, it could be the soundtrack to any adventure show, so...
Yeah.
There was a time when a theremin was shorthand for sci-fi, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's not really the case. We don't really hear that sort of this is sci-fi music thing quite so much in the prime time stuff.
No, you're right, and it has. It's made it more accessible, you know, and that's probably one of the reasons why it's a lot more popular now. One of the multitude of reasons why it's much more popular now is it has become more mainstream. But looking at the episode this week, it was very much sort of classic Doctor Who, really. Perhaps ideal material for having a little bit of a slightly more innovative electronic-sounding score.
With The Witch's Familiar, I was quite surprised at how, for me personally, how effective the music was, because I genuinely didn't really notice there even being any. Which is
a good sign. Yes, it's a good sign. I think from the music point of view about the story, it worked. It did work. It's just that I would like it to have been a little bit more scary. I think the script and a lot of the visuals were leading the viewer towards being a bit scared. That was the idea. You know, it was supposed to be classic frightening Doctor Who. And the problem for me was that the soundtrack, although it worked, was, as I said before, kind of generic adventure music, rather than what I used to be scared by just listening to the soundtrack. And it wasn't a scary soundtrack, whereas I think there would have been room for it. I don't know whether or not maybe they might have thought it was going to get too scary if the soundtrack was scary too.
So I wonder then, because there is a more experimental episode of Doctor Who coming up later on in the run, I wonder if they would give Murray Gold a chance to just fly a bit, as it were, you know? Because initially when it came back in 2005, I know he was putting in, because the run across the bridge in London was supposed to be reminiscent of the Pixies, wasn't it? Of Misery Lou, I think, which was quite different and quite poppy. And it's surprising watching the Christopher Eccleston run with the music in that, how it's almost as though this is the one chance I've got to do this, because there was no guarantee it was going to carry on. So it's almost as though they all throw everything that they've got at it, and the music as well is quite in some ways that, and the second series where you had the Doomsday theme, which where the starting on the bass line when the David Tennant Doctor and Rose have been separated across the universes, and the music carries on through a scene and carries across, that felt quite imaginative in a way. And rather than it was just trying to be, you know, sort of like you've saved your whip, now you need to save your hat as the temple walls close down behind you, that kind of a music thing going with it, it was almost more personal, I think.
Well, it was quite interesting hearing an interview with Murray about when he started doing music for Doctor Who. Right at the very beginning, he thought he was doing electronic music, and that's what he thought Doctor Who would need. And he did a sort of demo, did a load of demo tracks to play to Russell, and but in amongst them was a piece or a cue that was orchestral, or you know, semi-orchestral. And Russell went, "Yeah, that's what we want." And so he was then sort of pushed in the direction of doing it all in a fairly orchestral sort of style. Yeah. And as I said earlier on, once they've done that and it's been successful, the whole mix of the show has been successful, they're frightened of changing any element. And that's why it's probably been difficult for Murray, even if he wanted to do a more electronic or a more innovative musical style.
Yeah.
You know, because people don't want to change something that's working.
Yeah.
Or they don't want to change an element of something that's working overall as a whole, you know.
So, what did we think of the episode?
Ah, good one. Well, I mean, I really, really enjoyed it. Personally, I really enjoyed it. I just felt it was like going back into my childhood, really. It was full of... It was a fanboys episode, really, wasn't it? It was full of references to sort of childhood games of Daleks. When I was growing up in the 60s, what we used to wander around the playground doing was going, "I am a Dalek, I am a Dalek." Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was just... I think they were pandering to Dalek fans, basically, and nothing wrong with that, really. I really enjoyed it. I thought there were a few things that are a little bit uncomfortable with. Generally speaking, though, I thought it was a terrific episode, and I loved all the references to the past and the old Daleks, and You know, it was clearly a 1960s Dalek episode done in the contemporary production style.
Well, it's like a modern version of it's sort of taking the 60s Dalek stories and Genesis of the Daleks and things and exploring them with a it's not so much a remix, it's more a reimagining, isn't it? It's a take.
Yeah, it's almost like the Power of the Daleks missing episode done again kind of thing. It was all that kind of stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the way that the Dalek would, I definitely think you're onto something with the "I am a Dalek" in the playgrounds, with that being what the Dalek automatically turned your voice into when you're inside it. That must have sent quite a chill down a few backs, I would have
thought. Clever bit of writing, I thought. Very clever bit of writing, written with a lot of love, you know, no doubt written with a lot of love, but very clever bit of writing.
Yeah.
A lot of people made some comparisons with The Magician's Apprentice last week and Genesis of the Daleks. Do you think moving on to The Witch's Familiar as a separate episode, albeit part of a two-parter, are there any comparisons to be made thematically with things we've seen before?
Thematically?
Mm.
Interesting.
Mm. Well, I suppose moral dilemmas, you know, the... If I do this, this will happen, or should I do this, or because that might happen. I think that's possibly a linking theme. And it's all picking up, as you say, from picking up from different episodes in the past. I think it's reasonable to suggest that they're quite closely linked, the two episodes, in thematically speaking. And they certainly would work as a whole. And am I right in thinking that BBC One actually showed them as a whole the following day? Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think on the Sunday they showed them together, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost the themes of sort of actions and consequences, isn't it? Which has been part of Doctor Who right the way back to the 60s. It's always had this kind of thing going, whether it be in the Aztecs where you've got, you know, you can't change history, not one line, to last week where we had the Doctor on top of a tank playing Queen songs in medieval England, which is a bit of a jump, but it was okay for him to do that in that particular time because the character's coming to an end, but he's breaking all of his rules throughout it, and yet he's sort of escaped his consequences. Whereas with the this is something that's definitely happened with Doctor Who, because it happened in Time Lash, where he returns to the planet that he's been to before in his third incarnation, and it also happened in Chris Boucher's The Face of Evil, didn't it, when the Fourth Doctor's forgotten entirely visiting a planet before, until he sees a huge Jabba-like carving of his face in the side of a mountain, and it's so these sorts of things. Definitely, I think you're onto the themes and the responses. Did anyone think Davros had turned nice?
No,
no, but I did wonder whether we'd gone slightly too far in the empathy stakes on this. That was the only, I said I had slight reservation. That was the only really. I wondered whether, even implying that there might be any empathy or a softening of Davros, even though obviously it turned out not to be true, but whether or not the Doctor would ever believe for a moment that was the case, I think that was probably the bit I thought, sure about that.
But the only question was whether or not the Doctor believed it, because before the Doctor comes in and the very emotional interchange, which I'm going to admit, I don't usually go in for the sentimental stuff on Doctor Who, but it did affect me personally a little bit this time. But Davros does say to Colony Sarf in a preceding scene explicitly that he intends to entrap a Time Lord. That's one of his lines.
Yeah, yeah.
So we know that he's playing some kind of game here. So we already know that Davros is playing a game. It's whether or not the Doctor's going to fall for it.
Well, that's right. And is it expecting a bit much of us to think that the Doctor would fall for that? That was... probably what I was thinking. There's a lot of double bluff going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But it's a minor quibble, to be honest, it's a minor quibble, because I think it was, overall, I think the whole thing was very neatly written, actually.
Well, on the point that it was quite neatly written, when Davros says that he intends to entrap a Time Lord, he may not have got the better of the Doctor, but the last we see of Missy in this episode is her surrounded by Daleks saying she's got a very clever idea. So maybe, do you think it's possible that Davros has entrapped a Time Lady and is going to get to bend Missy to her will to save her life.
Mmm, interesting. Could be, could be.
We're about doing another team up, aren't we? Surely we must be. I mean, it's been a while since Planet of the Daleks. There must be another.
They have form.
Yeah, they do.
But I would say one of the things that we may have touched upon this earlier, we're talking about the two episode concept of a cliffhanger. And I kind of think this is a really good move for Doctor Who. Doctor Who was always, aside from one of the other things we've talked about, which is electronic music being a part of Doctor Who, the other thing, cliffhangers have always been a part of Doctor Who, and I kind of have always missed, since it came back in 2005, I've missed that. First of all, I've missed the cliffhanger, and secondly, I've missed the time that's been available to sort of expand on a plot. You know, one of my criticisms of Doctor Who since it's returned has been the speed at which we've had to whip through a story, because it's all got to be done in 45 minutes or less sometimes. Mm. So I think it lends itself far better, storytelling-wise, to have two 45 or 50-minute episodes rather than trying to cram everything into a ridiculously fast-moving 45-minute episode, which is what we've had in the past. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, it's giving it the space to tell the story and also to allow the characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think Stephen Moffat had said that every time since the introduction of Davros, every time Davros and the Doctor have had a scene together, it's just electric. It always has been. The two characters play off each other extremely well.
Yeah,
and the actors have been very, very good. And so he wanted a chance to really give that a shot with that second episode, which is essentially, well, with Witches Familiar, it's almost a two-hander, isn't it?
Yeah.
With Missy and Clara as are almost pet, you know, being the comic relief to retain everyone's attention while this quite heavy conversation is taking place between two mortal enemies, which is...
I don't know, this is another slight minor criticism of the production, really, but... I don't know what you thought about Davros. Davros, I thought, looked fantastic.
Yeah.
But I wanted him to go a bit manic. he was a little bit too vulnerable. Even once he'd been regenerated with energy, I wanted him to really do some of his, you know, real scary stuff, you know, that he does. I was thinking, bring back Terry Molloy at that point. You know,
yeah.
Really go for it.
We didn't have the Dalek voice, did we? Davros didn't do the Dalek voice. Yeah.
No, that's right. So visually, I thought he was fantastic. Really good at looking ill. He looked really ill. Yeah. But the voice wasn't... It wasn't doing it for me, I didn't think.
Actually, that was the only reason that I really found it quite so moving was Julian Bleach's performance. I thought he was absolutely remarkable. And I think, I think he underplayed it in a way that... performers haven't been given the opportunity as Davros before. I kind of appreciated it. I completely understand how for a lot of people they would want to see shrieking Davros.
Well, I wanted it to turn into shrieking Davros. I completely agree with you. The performance when he is being vulnerable was fantastic. I just wanted to see more of a change once the sort of energy transference thing had happened. I wanted him to, you know, get back to the screaming, shouting Davros that we all know and hate.
I suppose now we've seen him as a sort of old man Davros, as it were.
Yeah.
If he returns, which I have a suspicion he probably will, to be honest.
You think?
Who can tell? But I think there'll probably be some proper bellowing and spittle going all over the place when he comes back. And
yeah.
Excellent. That's what we.
Yeah.
Unless Al's got a closing question before we offer you the opportunity to plug your EPs and things.
I've got a specific one, actually.
Go on.
Which is a bit weird. It's was the Sir Ziggy remix of the Doctor Who theme, was that done with Justin McKay as the band?
Well, first of all, let me correct you. It's Syzygy.
Sorry.
Which is not your fault, honestly. We came up with that name and... nobody ever spells it right, and nobody can ever pronounce it. It's one of those things you regret. Why did we ever call ourselves Syzygy? No, Syzygy. It was two of us. Me and Justin were a recording act in the 90s, Syzygy. Mm-hmm. And the remix was done basically with my parts that I then sent to Justin, who's now living in France. Uh-huh. And so we were kind of doing it across the miles. But the Syzygy remix is largely Justin's work on my parts that I sent to him.
So what have you got coming out subsequently, you know, recently or soon?
Well, working backwards, yeah, the most recent thing is the back catalogue of Syzygy music, which is largely electronica. We were kind of on an underground dance label in London in the 90s. And it was some of it's more dance floor orientated, and some of it's a bit more chill out, ambient electronica, including our album Morphic Resonance, which is very much a sort of underground electronic album. So that's coming out. In fact, that's just come out, and the album's called Morphic Resonance. But just prior to that, I've had a couple of remix EPs. Of Doctor Who music, as you mentioned, the Gallifrey remixes, which is my theme music versions, the new versions of the theme music, which I've put out as an EP, and that's available on iTunes and Amazon and all those digital download sites. And then I followed that up with another EP, which is remixes of music, incidental music from my episodes of Doctor Who. And that's called the Ravelox Remixes, and there are four tracks on that. And again, that's out on iTunes and Amazon and Juno Records and all those sort of places.
Okay, right. Well, thank you very much, Dominic Glynn. Hopefully people will track your stuff down. I highly recommend that they do, because it's extremely good. And,
thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for coming on to After Nine.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Guys, it's Lizzie and Alicia here today.
Yo!
Hello! And we are back for another discussion on the latest episode of Doctor Who, The Witch is Familiar.
I don't get that title.
I don't get it either.
Where's the witch and where's the familiar? I don't understand.
It's like the first episode was The Magician's Apprentice. Not once did I see a Magician's Apprentice in the episode.
Unless it's like a reference to the Doctor and Davros, because they both are masters at their own crafts.
Yeah.
That's the thing, you've got, like, the Doctor is a symbol of a magician, and Davros is kind of a apprentice, because he's making the thing that, you know, the Doctor absolutely hates. So it's kind of witchcraft, I suppose. Yeah. But it still doesn't make sense.
Well, The Witch is Familiar, it could be about Missy, her being a witch kind of character, and it's being quite familiar with her traits and everything.
Or it's a really, really bad slap on Clara. Yeah. It's one of those.
So, Davros, what did you think of him?
Son of a beep. That's what I think, but to be honest, I knew it, he was going to backstab. I just knew it in the episode. You could just tell with him. Literally, he opens his eyes and I'm like, oh, that's so big, cute.
Oh, he's so cute.
He's not going to, yeah, it's like, oh, look, he's so cute. He's an old ugly man. He's not going to hurt anyone. He's elderly. He's in a, you know, little Dalek chair for God's sakes. And then all of a sudden, every time the Doctor kept going close to him, I was literally like, he's going to pull out a gun, yeah. Run, he's going to pull out a gun, run! And literally with the hand, I was like, his face, I knew it! I knew it! I was screaming at you for 20 minutes, I knew it! I wasn't actually screaming, but in my head I was.
But yeah, with me, I wanted to feel sympathy for Davros, and then I did, and then all of a sudden he tricks me, and I thought,
you really not
this again. And, literally, I had my dad watching it. He was like, oh, he's going to pull out a gun or something.
Thank
I'm
going
to trick him. And then there's just me like, no, it's fine.
You're on about the guy that literally wants to kill him and then just, you know, kick him while killing him if possible.
You can't kick him.
I'm pretty sure you can get like a stick or something and just go, hey, told you guys I'll do it. I did it.
So, Clara.
I was just so happy to see her hanging there while Missy was thinking of killing her.
happy days for me. Oh. So I really don't like Clara. She's just horrible.
I actually liked her in these two episodes, and then in other episodes, I don't know why I can't stand her.
I'm up and down. At the moment, I still don't like her, but I'm just up and down with her because she's some moments I'm like, okay, you're okay. In this one, I'm just like, Missy, please kill her. Please kill her. Do it.
She has the chance. Why didn't you kill her?
I loved it when Missy put her in the Dalek, where she's like, right, Clara, we're going to turn you into a Dalek today. And, oh, it's just, I love it when Missy turns around and goes, Clara, say I love you, exterminate. Say, I miss you, exterminate. Say you want to live, exterminate.
Apparently, there was a scene in the episode where Missy swore. I don't know if you caught that.
I keep remembering a certain scene where she did swear. I just missed it off, to be honest. I was too paying attention to, yeah, like, Clara nearly getting shot by a doctor, which I was thinking, do it.
I missed that scene. There's been quite an outrage of it, actually, her swearing. Apparently she says the B word. I'm not going to say what that B word is, because we're a very family-friendly podcast.
Oh, you mean beep?
Yep. What do you think about Missy swearing?
To be honest, people do it all the time. I mean, I'm horrible for swearing, so yeah. I can't judge. I mean, it's one little word, you know, if she's going to...
It could be worse.
Yeah, she could have said such... I've had sailors say worse than that word, so...
Yeah, I mean, she could have gone all Malcolm Tucker and, you know, said, oh, you beep and beep and go away, you beep.
Okay, if everyone's going to judge someone for swearing, look at Peter Capaldi and his recent roles. Yeah. I mean, for beep's sake. Yeah. See, I'm doing beeps now. I'm doing beeps. There you go. Brilliant. Look at Beeps Capaldi. Yep. He's done a lot of beeps in his roles. Yeah. So beep, 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 beep.
So what do you think happened to Davros at the end? Do you think he survived?
Probably, yes. I mean, I think he's kind of survived because we didn't see him really die. I've just got a feeling he's still dying, but I think he's still out there because if he's got a bit of regeneration energy, I don't know if that's slowly going to kill him or it's quicker.
It's going to make him live longer.
Oh, well, he'll be fine then. That kind of backfired.
But you know the character that's the leader of the snake? Voldemort guy.
Oh, him, Voldemort.
I can't remember his name. I think it's General Sarf or something like that.
I just nickname him Voldemort now.
Voldemort.
He's got a nurse, so that's a bit nice.
I think he took Davros somewhere else, and now Davros is safe. I think so. That's my theory.
Either that or Davros has kind of eaten him and then gained, like, you know, he doesn't have to hunt.
Unlike Missy.
Missy should eat Clara.
Decaying Daleks in the sewers. What did you think of that concept? Did you like it? Did you hate it?
Daleks in the sewers?
Yeah, in the
sewers. Daleks in the sewers?
You know the bit where Missy turns Clara into a Dalek?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and you've got all the kind of grunge on the wall. That started decaying Daleks.
Oh.
Yeah. Very nice.
I just thought, okay. I just loved it when they just, like, were all going, I'm dying! And all of a sudden you just see one explode and then you got the other one just going slushy everywhere. Yeah. It looks like someone's literally got blackcurrant slushy. Done!
Oh, that's horrible. But no, I actually cried.
You cried?
Because dying Daleks, it got to my heartstrings. Especially Davros when he started crying with the Doctor, and then all of a sudden he was like, no, I'm gonna kill you.
Oh, was I the only one when they all, like, exploding and dying, hear the little screams in the background? Was I the only one that went, ah?
Yeah, I really want a Capaldi Davros figure now. I think they need to release those in shops.
I want a Missy one. Sorry,
yeah,
Missy's
like... releasing Missy figures.
One thing I've got to say, why did you do that, Peter? Missy was fine! She was fine! Why did you abandon
her? If that was me, I would have killed Missy on the spot, because... I liked Missy to begin with, but I didn't really think there was a lot to her character. But I watched her in today's episode, and I loved her. Well, not today's episode, last week's episode. And I fell in love with her. I think she's now the master. The fact that she's so manipulative. But yeah, so we're gonna have to end quickly. So,
okay.
Out of 10.
1,005,500.
I was going to say 12, but...
Yeah, I know what you did last week, so I'm doing this this week.
But that's all I've got time for, guys. But thank you very much for listening, and we shall see you next week.
You'll be great listeners!
Goodbye!
Okay, so it's Al, and I'm here with...
Well, I'm not Al.
I'm the him. Okay. We just finished watching The Witch is Familiar.
Why do they have these names?
Well, The Witch is Familiar was about... That was Clara. And The Magician's Apprentice was Davros, by the looks of it.
But why do they have these names?
Why do they have these names?
Yes.
Well, because otherwise it would be Genocide of the Daleks and Prisoner of Davros or something. I don't know.
Davros of the Daleks.
Davros of the Daleks, yeah. Sidemen of the Daleks.
Seward of the Daleks.
Seward of the Daleks, could have been that one. So that reminded me a bit of Curse of Fatal Death. I have a suspicion that the hybrid we've already seen, because when we were talking about two warlike races, it wasn't very definite Daleks, and I think we might be explaining that the Doctor is the hybrid between the two warlike races of the Time Lords and humanity.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, okay. It was nice to see that the Danger Mouse agenda was back in. with the...
Vampire monkeys.
The vampire monkeys.
The pit of vampire monkeys.
Yes, and then there was the pointed stick. Yeah. And they could always eat a Metaltron. I thought Missy and Clara make a good team.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Did you not? Although I am rooting...
I wouldn't have called it a good team.
I'm rooting more for Missy. Which can't be right.
Well, there's always another Clara.
Well, yeah, she is the impossible girl who's everywhere. Seek, locate, destroy.
Align and advance. Advance and attack. Attack and destroy. Destroy and rejoice.
Yeah, you spotted that one.
I didn't say that. It just came to mind.
And as you pointed out, why do they have another plastic chair on Skaro?
No, why do they have a plastic chair on Skaro? Why do they have plastic on Skaro? Why do they have a chair on Skaro?
Well, the chair on Skaro is probably, you know, they've got to sit someone down before you, you know, when you... That way, well, after the Gardener Daleks managed to entice them in with baskets full of fruit and all sorts of stuff like that.
But there are no Thals on this planet.
No, there don't seem to be. Thals haven't been mentioned once, have they?
Well, that's because Davros rebuilt it. Mm-hmm. With steamrollers.
Yeah.
And he didn't replant Thals.
No, and those sewers filled up pretty quickly.
But that, is that, like, made out of bits of old Skaro? Because it makes no sense. And not only that, why is there, like, a tunnel through it?
Oh, well, it's the sewers, isn't it?
But why is it the ceiling as well?
I don't know.
Who stuck them on the ceiling?
They've always got to go like that, though. I liked, I thought Julian Bleach's performance as Davros was excellent. I thought that was really good. It was going through kind of like the bit from Dalek where you've got a sympathetic Dalek to actually turn it around that much and have the Doctor and Davros have this kind of link. I thought was very clever.
We need to talk.
We need to talk. Yeah, it wasn't quite to, Walking Dead level of chatting about stuff, but there was
it was
there was an awful lot of just chatting about stuff, wasn't there? Yeah. Yeah, it was fine. It did what it did. It was good. Good performances. Very good performances from Peter Capaldi and all the regulars. They were very good. I have to admit, I do feel a bit underwhelmed.
Only now.
Yeah. Because that's not the end of that story. That's the first two parts of a multi-part Dalek story, quite obviously.
Do we need more Daleks? Do we really need more Daleks?
I think we need an annual dose of Daleks just to make sure we keep getting Daleks.
To be honest, I could live without Daleks.
What would you have instead of the Daleks?
The Zarbi.
Bring back Zombo, the first of the Boy Genius companions.
No, I don't know what you could have instead of the Daleks, but I'm sure that, I don't know, maybe like Sporks would be a suitable replacement.
Well, we've had Spoonheads, haven't we? So we're on a planet of the Sporks. Yeah.
That sounds a bit
Spork to Doomsday. Okay, I suppose we've got to keep doing hissing noises, haven't we?
Well, no, because Snake Man didn't...
Corny South, innit?
Wait, why did all the buildings collapse?
Because Dalek's buildings do. That's just what they do.
But why?
Because they do. don't know. I like the way that there was. I was watching one and I thought that it exploded really rather nicely. I was quite impressed with that.
But why did it explode?
Well, at the end of a story that they do. This isn't, as I've said, this isn't the end of a story. This is just set another one up. It's going to be all about Gallifrey and why he left, and, you know, it could be...
But why do they explode?
Because they always explode.
But that makes no sense.
So hissing...
It makes no sense anyway.
No.
I mean, why did angry zombie Dalek paste things... What? Well, why do they try and only kill other Daleks?
Oh, it's because they're angry about not being Daleks anymore.
Like, very specifically, other Kaleds, because they won't go after you if you're anything else in a Dalek suit.
That's true. That was a bit weird, I don't know.
This name trend isn't going to continue, though. Like, the next ones are not going to be called, like,
no,
it'll the Shoemaster's Spark.
No, it'll be the something of the Daleks next time. No, we've had two Dalek stories that don't mention Daleks, then. Or one Dalek story, or a bit of a Dalek story. I don't know.
Come on, there's not really much left as far as of the Daleks is concerned.
No, they've probably all been done. The whole of the R section of the Oxford English Dictionary has definitely been done.
You just can't remember between Remembrance, Revelation and Resurrection.
Can you?
Remembrance of the Daleks is the Sylvester McCoy one. Revelation of the Daleks is the Tom Baker one.
Oh, no.
I don't know. How am I supposed to know?
Destiny of the Daleks. None of the Tom Baker ones have got R as well. Anyway, on that bombshell...
That's how confusing it is.
Here comes a clam.
A clam?
Where? Dalek face anime! Dalek face anime! Dalek
face anime! Dalek face anime! What?
Whether it be the sweeping eagle in his flight... Are the open apple blossom, the toiling workhorse, the blithe swan, the branching oak, the winding stream at its base, the drifting clouds, over all the coursing sun. Form ever follows function, and this is the law. Where function does not change, form does not change. It is the pervading law of all things organic and inorganic, of all things physical and metaphysical, of all things human and all things non-human, of all true manifestations of the head, of the heart, of the soul, that the life is recognizable in its expression, that form ever follows function. This is the law. Stranger on the Shore, Designing Daleks. The Daleks first appeared on screen in the second Doctor Who adventure in 1963. They were created in-house at the BBC by a designer called Ray Cusack. Like Davros, the on-screen creator of the Daleks, Ray studied maths and science and served for the army. Unlike Davros, however, Ray was a very nice man and on leaving the army went to work in repertory theatre. Before joining the Beeb, Ray Cusack was a staff set designer, creating sets for the Sunday Night Play and sitcoms like Sykes. But in 1963, due to a schedule clash, a young designer named Ridley Scott was taken off Doctor Who Serial B and Ray replaced him. This led to one of the greatest creations in not only sci-fi history, but also in design. Ray is a true example of a great designer where your brain must function as two separate contrasting organisms to create a glorious whole. Basically, the left-hand side that knows about law, regulations, ergonomics, order and logic, and the right-hand side that looks for shapes in clouds, plays with Lego, sings, dances and laughs. Combined, you get the perfect design. One of the best design theories that demonstrates this is form follows function, as you heard all about at the beginning. And to tell you about that, I'll need to go to New York! I'm in Manhattan. Its sensational skyline of skyscrapers revolutionised the way we build, live and work. One of the pioneers of the multi-floored building was architect Louis Sullivan. And it was in an article Sullivan wrote in 1896 entitled The Tall Office Building, Artistically Considered, that he came up with a key design philosophy that is taught to new designers to this day as the essential tool which unlocks good design. The philosophy of form follows function. And that is the law. The Daleks look like no other space monster of the time. In fact, mechanical menaces in the movies of the day were nothing more than automated men, which went back to the 50s with Gort and Robbie the Robot being the standouts, but very much men in suits. More form follows form than form follows function. Ray only had one simple note from Dalek writer Terry Nation. The Daleks should glide and have no visible legs. This is the starting point of any design, a brief from the client. The next step is ideas. Ray knew that the Dalek would be operated by a person, so that silhouette in a number of positions, standing, laying, or sitting, would be at the heart of the design. Having the performer sit meant the Dalek could be squat and more sinister, and raised the question as to if there actually was a person in it. Early drawings considered having the Dalek built around a tricycle. This is a budgetary idea, to buy an existing item and adapt it. However, a simple wooden bench with the actor pushing the Dalek around with their feet was deemed even cheaper. Other aspects of the design development came about because of the demands of logic. The lights on the dome, for instance, were put on at the request of series directors Christopher Barry and Richard Martin, so they knew which Daleks were talking. Strangely, the magical design aspects of the Daleks also has its foot in logic. The logic of the fictitious world they inhabit, a world which evolved over the first Dalek stories. In the first story, the Daleks do not move out of their city on Skaro and use static electricity to glide. The logic here that they use the same technology as a dodgem car. In the second Dalek adventure, they invade Earth and have dishes fitted to them, as if they are transmitting power from a greater source on their flying saucers. In the third story, The Chase, the recognisable shoulder slats appear, and Ray stated that these were solar panels to demonstrate how their motivational power had moved on. Once Ray left the series, Dalek evolution stopped, and any changes consisted simply of paint jobs and changing the bulbs to car indicators during the 1970s. One notable exception was, of course, the use of an ever-ready torch on the Supreme Dalek in Planet of the Daleks. Many think this is to demonstrate he was the boss Dalek and had to look different. Others say that because the Dalek props were in such a state of disrepair that instead of making a new eye stalk to replace a damaged one, they simply nicked the floor manager's torch while he was on lunch. Adding slots to the plungers in remembrance of the Daleks helped them to lock into the controls of their shuttle. And of course, the special weapons Dalek was introduced. I always wondered why there was only one special weapons Dalek, though. If that was a better weapon for destruction, why didn't they all upgrade? When the series returned in 2005, so did the Daleks. Cusack's familiar shape remained, but it was beefed up with rivets and a chunkier metal look. When Ray went for a tour of the Cardiff set and was shown the new Daleks, he wasn't impressed. The production designer, Ed Thomas, told Ray they added the rivets to make the Daleks look like they had been constructed on a production line. Ray pointed out that was an Earth method of production, as were the B&Q fixtures and fittings. His Dalek was meant to look like it had been produced in a way that no one on Earth would comprehend. I will even go as far to say, as far as evolution goes, the new Dalek paradigm would probably have been more accepted by Ray than the bronze models of the RTD era. With colour codes based on the warning colours of various plants and animals, and scope for a variety of add-ons, tools and weapons to be attached for all aspects of war and world domination. In 1989, for their 25th anniversary, Doctor Who magazine asked Ray to design a Dalek as if for a movie with modern budgets. Other than the general shape, it was to the original Dalek what the Model T Ford is to the Ford GT. The overall metal of the Dalek would be iridescent, with purple and green hues, and should look like no metal on Earth. Inspired by nature, barbs on the weapons would stop pesky Time Lords from spinning the metal monsters down corridors. Gone is the eye stalk, two lenses with retractable covers give the Dalek wider vision that will never be impaired, and power worries of the past are long gone with an inbuilt nuclear plant. Ray and Davros have more in common than we think. Both scientists, both from the military, both designing with logic, both with an interest in war. In fact, Ray was something of a military historian, having posthumously published a book on the tactics and history of the Duke of Wellington. And of course, both created the Daleks. Then there was the darker side. Using Ray's wares rather than those of Davros, both were pretty cheesed off. Ray, because as a staff designer, he was entitled to none of the wealth the BBC or Terry Nation earned from the Daleks. And Davros, well, he was pretty cheesed off with everyone. The whole universe, in fact. However we look at the Daleks, they are pure design, made for a job. But the attention to detail, created by necessity, has made them a design classic. Which is why it's so frustratingly awkward to redesign them, and why the paradigm was so disliked by much of fandom. But with the apparent destruction once more of the Dalek City, and Davros, who knows what's next for the Daleks, and in what form they'll come back.
What did we think of the next time tease? I thought it looked pretty good.
Really?
Yeah, I think it looks really positive.
Underwater, on ice, in space, in HD, in 3D.
Yep, exactly.
It's going to be nuclear.
It looks good. It looks good. It's based under siege.
The next time teaser. So if we've just seen possibly the best two-parter since Time of the Angels, then I guess things have got to calm down and go back to normal, and the stakes have got to lower a little tiny bit.
The next episode teaser reminded me a lot like Flatline. These individuals that can, you know, just kind of appear through the walls. I love ghosts, so this next episode looks good.
If I'm honest, I didn't pay that much attention to the next time tease. It looked interesting visually. I didn't get much from it in terms of what to expect narratively.
The preview for next week, I don't know. It doesn't really do anything for me, honestly. I feel like it's something we've seen multiple times and just not that interesting, and those things are creepy. Maybe I'll watch it and I'll be totally blown away by it, but yeah, right now, not so much.
A base under siege? Hello, the Troughton years are calling, and that's not a bad thing, especially when it seems we have spooky ghost-like apparitions getting around the place. I've got a DWM here that has a preview of this episode, but I haven't read it yet, so I really don't know what to expect. Something I do know, however, is I think we're up to the two-parter in this series, which is being told in reverse order. It's going to be an interesting time.
You have been hearing Andy, Beth, Al, Rob, Little Bo, The Him, Lizzie, Alicia, Ian, Kate and Lex. You can find out all about us at thedwshow.net and find us on Twitter and Facebook by searching The DW Show, that's with a capital D and a capital W, and you can email us at hello@thedwshow.net. The DW is in capitals. Our theme tune is by Dominic Glynn and is available as part of the Gallifrey Mixes on Amazon and iTunes. Thanks for listening.